Hello and welcome to the April 15th, 2023 edition of Ukraine Without Hype. I am Anthony Bardaway and I'm here with my colleague Romeo Kakratsky.
Hi, all.
Last episode, we described how we would be wanting to mix and match our episodes a bit more between news digests like the previous episode, more analytical ones that we just do ourselves, and also interviews. This episode will be something of a mixture of a news digest and the analytical. We'll have a smaller number of topics than we did last episode, for example, but try to go a bit more in depth into each one. Just playing around with format, seeing what is most appropriate for any given week. But on that, into our combat update. And as of last episode, the only major changes have happened in Bakhmut. So within Bakhmut, the Russian forces are now contesting the city center. They have crossed the Bakhmutka River. They have worked their way past the northern industrial area and are now fighting within the city center itself. With territory changing hands constantly, it is urban warfare that we're talking about right now, where every building and every block has to be fought over. And it's very difficult to actually track what is and is not happening there because of the press blackout and just because there are such rapid changes happening. We did see that the Russians were able to, quote unquote, capture the city administration building, which mostly amounted to raising a flag over the rubble of what used to be the city administrative building. Russians have presented this as them somehow having legal control over the city because they now control what used to be the city center or the city administration. The real world does not work like that. It is not a game of capture the flag, but that's what they've gone off on for whatever reason. If there is a front line, as much as you can call it that, it is at the train station in the center of the city, with again different pushes going back and forth, including some news of Russian soldiers capturing Ukrainian positions, only for that Ukrainian position then to be detonated because it was booby-trapped. Gruesome fighting, urban fighting, and very unclear fog of war fighting. But the good news that we can say about this is that the risk of encirclement of the forces there seems to largely be gone at this point. The Russians have not made any progress north or south of the city in several weeks. They are not able to close the city off from its supply lines, which means that the Ukrainian soldiers there will be able to hold their ground as long as they can without so much risk of being cut off. Now, there is still very much a possibility of Bakhmut falling within the coming weeks, although we've been saying that all year, and they're still holding on. But at least this time, it seems that unlike Severodonetsk, where the withdrawal from that city was very much complicated by the Russians being able to cut them off in a very tight salient, that does not seem to be the case with Bakhmut. Whereas with Severodonetsk, there were lots of little pockets of Ukrainian soldiers that were left behind and captured because they were cut off and surrounded in smaller level units. Again, Bakhmut doesn't seem like that will occur. And also the fact that Russia has been able to push the front line, I say once again with heavy quotes considering it's not a line, deeper into the city, that also means that the Ukrainian forces are not in as tight of a salient because the Russians have, you know, pushed forward onto the bulge of Ukrainian controlled territory. They pushed it backwards, so it's not protruding as much into Russian held territory as it was before. So, yes, it is bad that that Ukraine is losing ground in the city, but it is losing ground in such a way that they are able to withdraw when they feel it is necessary to withdraw without being caught on the way. The other place to look at is Avdiivka. Avdiivka is this other strong site. We've described it before. It's a suburb just outside of the city of Donetsk, made formerly a serious industrial center, though at this point it is now largely in ruin, much like Bakhmut is. And here again, the fog of war situation has been very confusing to try and follow along what is happening there. Various sources are more pessimistic and others are more conservative in their assessments of how much territory Russia controls around Avdiivka. The more pessimistic map, such as Lavyuwe, for example, has presented Russian positions as nearly encircling the city, including capturing a significant amount of territory to the north of the city, cutting it off from the Slovyansk, Kramatorsk, Konstantinivka urban conglomeration, I suppose you can call it, where including capturing the rail lines leading into the city. But now even those more pessimistic maps have shown that they've been driven away somewhat from this northern hold north of Avdiivka, while the more conservative maps that had always shown more Ukrainian held territory around the city never showed that area as being controlled by Russia in the first place. There's a lot of confusion going around of what counts as Russia holding territory, I suppose you can call it, making an advance, pushed away, where they're able to strike into, where they're able to strike into with regularity. So I've recommended the maps in our link tree, but keep in mind that they are doing the best they can with the information they have available. And the information available right now, especially in these two cities of Avdiivka and Bakhmut, is very, very minimal. But either way, there has not been a tremendous amount of change around Avdiivka for, again, the last few weeks, with the more conservative maps saying not at all of a change, while the more pessimistic maps, pessimistic meaning Russia controlling more, have shown Russia losing ground around the city. So it is one of the two. I've always tended to be more cautious when saying who advanced where, so I kind of side with the conservative estimates. But these are really the only two locations where there is a significant Russian offensive. The other parts of the front line, the other half dozen or so parts of the front line that we have been talking about through, you know, February, March, that included Vuhledar and these other locations where Russians were trying to do kind of a full court press on the Ukrainian side, most of that has burnt out and is now down to Avdiivka and Bakhmut. And really, considering the fact that nothing so much has changed around Avdiivka thanks to the defenders there, mostly just Bakhmut.
We can actually see that the Russians are running out of steam by looking at the reported loss rates that the Ukrainian military puts out for the past few weeks, really. While infantry casualties have remained at or above 500 per day, with some days spiking as high as 700 plus, in terms of materiel, they are losing a lot less than they had in previous stages of the war, which is likely an indicator that the Russians are likely running out of the physical ability to conduct these constant assaults, as well as stockpiling whatever they have left for the likely counteroffensive.
Yeah, we all really like to see those really high loss days where upwards of 1,000 Russians were being killed every single day and dozens of tanks, etc. But the fact that those days aren't happening anymore is basically just because there aren't all of those fronts open at the same time, like we were just talking about. Those very high number days came from, you know, Bakhmut, Vuhledar, Avdiivka, all these places to the northern stretch, Svatova, where all this fighting was happening very fiercely every single day. And that's why it added up. So now when the range of operations is much more narrow, that is why we are seeing these lower casualties, which is why the casualty number rate, the enemy materiel loss number rate, is another indicator that this spring offensive has basically petered out. But talking of soldiers and combat, We have one update this week, which is much more gruesome than normal, especially in the, you know, visual, visceral way. And that is that a video was sent around social media coming out of Russian Telegram channels of a Ukrainian soldier being beheaded by Wagnerites. These Wagner soldiers were egging each other on, haven't you ever cut off a head before, that kind of thing. While the Ukrainian was screaming in pain, it would do not watch this video. I watched it. Romeo, did you?
I did not.
Don't do it. There's no need to watch this. These kvats are always given away on, you know, Twitter or whatever of don't watch this video. Then they'll post a censored version of it. I'm not a big fan of that practice of saying, oh, everyone needs to see what the Russians are doing. In this case, you really don't have to. You knowing what happened is enough. So, listener, please do not watch this video. I did it for you. And take my word for it, it's really, really bad. So this video of this soldier being beheaded was sent around. And we don't know the identities of either the soldier being killed or the Wagnerites doing the killing, though the SBU did say that they had an idea of who the killers were, but nothing has really come out concrete about that. On one hand, this is somewhat new. There has not been beheading videos, but we have seen corpses who were beheaded. So there is nothing new under the sun for what kind of atrocities the Russians can do. There was the execution via hammer, and I don't know if decapitation is more shocking than hammer crushing is to anyone. I don't know if there's really a scale there to say what is new and what is not. Wagner was very much guilty of these kinds of crimes in Syria, in Libya, throughout Africa, and it has been doing it in Ukraine as well.
And there have been reports of Wagner or perhaps other Russian units putting severed heads on pikes in a nice throwback to feudalism. So it's very likely that this may be the first shared recorded video of this happening, but it's likely that incidents like this have occurred before and probably will happen again.
And of how the video looked and what they were saying during the video definitely at least implied that they had done this before. Like I said, they were egging on the soldier doing the beheading by saying, haven't you ever done this before? But to me, it looked like his hand was pretty steady for decapitating a human. So everyone involved had experience in this activity before. This has definitely happened before. There's probably videos of it on private servers or on people's individual phones. It's how it is. So that raises the question of why you would do this kind of thing. Well, what we know is that they have done it before, so it's not a mystery of them doing again what they've already done before. But from their perspective, this is supposed to terrify Ukrainians, possibly into making them surrender. This is not the first time they have tried to terrorize Ukrainians into surrender. There's just no proof that it works. And in fact, usually does the opposite. There was the terror bombing campaign over the winter, which in the end accomplished very little. There are all these other tactics they have used for the specific purpose of sowing terror and discord. Bucha, all these places, their reign of terror in Kherson and other occupied territory. And every single time, all it ever does is galvanize Ukrainians to fight them even harder. But in the fascist mind, this is an act of dominance that is supposed to show how they are the ones in charge. And of course, it's wrong because fascists are always wrong. From another perspective that comes from the sociological research into other wars where similar atrocities have taken place, this is also used as a form of unit cohesion. Once one person in your unit does the crime and you aid them or help them cover it up, you are now co-conspirators. You're all now in it together. You're all bounded by your common crime.
In a pithy way, the unit that commits war crimes together stays together.
Yeah, that's really what it is. It's an extraordinary experience that people share together. The psychology of it can be quite easily understood by your common corporate team building activity, really, except in case of instead of trust falls, in this case, it's war crimes. But in a perverse way, if you step aside and just kind of look at it from, you know, the academic point of view, that's kind of what's going on. It is a bizarre thing that someone would not do in their daily life that puts them in this extraordinary position with other people in the same extraordinary position.
And in fact, there's evidence of this psychology being exploited by Wagner before, after the Sledgehammer incident, where Wagner executed a returned Wagner prisoner with a sledgehammer for cowardice or weakness or whatever idiotic excuse they used. And then that sledgehammer, or just generally sledgehammers, have now sort of become an icon, a symbol of Wagner that signals that not only is a person toting around a sledgehammer charm or has one on their hoodie or t-shirt, not only are they in support of the full-scale invasion, but that they are happy and willing to support any level of atrocity committed against Ukrainians. Obviously, this does quite a bit for in-group cohesion, though obviously it doesn't exactly make the perpetrators look especially human for outsiders.
And of course, the other side of the coin here is that once indoctrinated into this kind of mindset, it is very difficult to go back. They are being turned into really a cult in a way. And if any of these Wagnerites survive and are released back into Russian society, you now have a violent death cult of people who view the world in a very certain way. And there are ways to ease people back into normal life. Even normal soldiers who haven't done such things often have trouble readjusting, but that's why you have psychological support and all that.
Well, you would in any other country that isn't named Russia.
Ideally, it's not great and in any place really, but in an ideal scenario, you want to be able to debrief people and bring them back into normality. This is not going to happen with Wagnerites. They're in it. They're not going to be taken out of it. So good luck, Russia, in the future with all that.
Or better yet, bad luck, and I hope their country falls apart even faster.
Oh no, this is going to be a major catalyst for any kind of civil unrest that happens. These people are war criminals for life at this point, and they're going to need to kill something. And if it's not Ukrainians, it's going to be Russians. And the third aspect of this, from a psychological standpoint, is again very much studied through all kinds of different conflicts, is that they basically are creating a scenario where their own soldiers will be less likely to surrender. On one, they'll say, look what we did to them. Now, if we surrender, they will do the same to us. So don't surrender. There's again tons of academic, especially as far as what I've read mostly has been in the context of, for example, Sierra Leone and the civil war there that occurred, where it was a very common tactic to specifically take part in horrendous war crimes so that the soldiers will be less likely to give up, because they know that the other side was out for revenge. And they have that in the back of their mind that they don't want to be the person to have revenge taken upon them. And the only way to do that is to never surrender. So that's the idea of it anyway. Of course, they still are surrendering in large numbers, as they always have. But when we hear about these horrific things, there is a perverse logic to it. Even if we look at that perverse logic, we see something even uglier underneath it than what existed even on the very brutal surface. Next will be, you know, my ongoing topic that I've been keeping close tabs on for many, many years. And that is the Russian Orthodox Church. We've done enough episodes. I don't need to go over everything again for the umpteenth time. I don't know how much people are super fixated on this topic as much as I, but right now it is very much at an inflection point. We were talking about how during Christmas, especially, the Kyiv-Pechersk Lavra, the center point of Orthodox Christianity in Ukraine, was in the process of being handed over from the Russian Orthodox Church to the Orthodox Church of Ukraine, now both versions of Orthodox Christianity. Now, an update to this is that the Russian Orthodox Church has kind of officially been ejected from the Lavra grounds. It's a very big territory. So when we are talking about just that one church within the Lavra, that did not account for the many, many. It's a very big place. If you come to Kyiv, I highly suggest going. It's kind of one of the historic architectural centerpieces of the city. There's a lot to see, museums, many churches, etc. But the Russian Orthodox Church were still holding on to parts of it, and now they are being asked to leave. We were talking before about how the Ministry of Culture was trying to do inspections of the territory, and the Russian church was threatening to kind of take everything on the way out. Well, they're still kind of in this weird in-between point where they're not wanting to fully leave. Though the rector of the territory, like the church official in charge of the Lavra specifically, rather than the church as a whole, is now under house arrest. So it's unfolding at a much more rapid pace than I thought. These arrests, these evictions have all been happening within the last, I thought this process might have taken months and months. It's coming down to weeks and weeks. But outside of just Kyiv, if you look to elsewhere in the country, there's been a spat of incidents that, taken individually, seem to come down to, you can point at a very specific reason why this incident occurred, but as a whole, we see a pattern of some kind of incident and a Russian-controlled church happening to kind of piss off the locals, and then the locals opting to switch the church over to the Ukrainian one. So if we look at Khmelnytsky, there was an incident where a soldier was kind of insulting to the priests at a church in Khmelnytsky, at which point the priest tried to beat the crap out of him, and he did not really fight. The soldier did not fight back. But after this incident occurred, many other people in Khmelnytsky did a huge demonstration, and they kind of forced the Russian priest out of this church and then held a vote to hand it over to the Ukrainian one. If we look at the Chernivtsi region, there was an incident where a soldier's family tried to bury him on church grounds. This was their, you know, village church, though it was controlled by, you know, the Russian Orthodox Church. It was very popular to go to in the village, because before recently, it really didn't matter as much. People would not take into much consideration who controlled the specific church they were going to. So they tried to bury this soldier on the village church grounds. The Russian church officials tried to stop them, again, huge outcry until the locals took over the church and handed it over to Ukrainian one. So there is this very rapid series of events happening around the country of the Russian Orthodox Church, which had already shrunk considerably from its pre-2022 levels, being driven out in a very rapid succession. I believe I saw the main Orthodox Church in Odessa, Russian Orthodox Church in Odessa, had exchanged. I don't know if that was a permanent thing or just for that day, or I don't know the whole story around that, but it happening in Odessa at all is pretty big deal because of Odessa being much more of a stronghold for a Russian Orthodoxy. Lviv, that one makes a bit more sense, that in Lviv, much more attuned to Ukrainian national identity, even before the conflicts. Their Russian Orthodox Church had a vote to be handed over to the Ukrainian one. So the dominoes are falling very, very quickly to what I thought would be a process that would last all year is happening within a month. Though we are trying to release this on Saturday, Sunday, when many of you may be listening for the first time, will be Easter according to the Orthodox calendar. This is, of course, the biggest day of the year in Christianity, and so it will be the biggest day in the year for the Russian Orthodox Church in Ukraine. I am expecting there to be something that will happen somewhere. I don't know where, I don't know what, but I feel in my gut that there will be some kind of demonstration at some church that may spill over into being something more serious. There may be a church that gets seized. There may be priests who do something. I don't know. I'm waiting for tomorrow.
So the big story, aside from the beheadings and church issues, has, of course, been this enormous, enormous leak of classified U.S. documents that have circulated on the internet for quite a while now. According to Politico, these documents started popping up online as early as March, though they didn't really see mainstream attention until earlier this month, around the start of April. And they contain a, as one can imagine, wealth of information. And before we talk into who leaked it and their possible motivations for leaking it and all the revelations about that, let's talk about the leaks itself and what exact intel the leaks had. So one of the most focused on portions of the leaks were U.S. intelligence reports documenting the war, obviously, since the U.S. is heavily involved in setting up basically the entire logistics chain for the Ukrainian military at this point. And as a result, the U.S. has a lot of access to Ukrainian intelligence as well as estimates of KIAs on both sides and approximate operational combat strengths for both sides. So according to U.S. estimates, the Russians have lost anywhere from 35 to 45,000 soldiers KIA, while the comparable numbers on the Ukrainian side range from 15 to 17,000. So it's about a 1-to-3 ratio there of kill counts for both sides. Obviously, this is a pretty good sign for Ukraine, showing that Ukraine is managing its defenses very well and is taking far less losses in this kind of war of attrition than the Russians. Though, of course, with Russia's much larger population, Russia can proportionally afford these losses, or at least in theory, they can afford these losses. The leaks also documented the composition and supply schedules for Ukrainian military units, the location of air defenses in Ukraine. And while this data isn't completely fresh, this was not data as of April 4th or whatever. It was, I believe, The latest dates on the documents put them in late March. Obviously, this intelligence is still pretty valuable for anyone looking to properly analyze the capabilities of the Ukrainian military. And obviously, that is going to be a goal of Russian military planners. They are very likely still poring over these documents and analyzing them for every last scrap of usable intelligence that they can get. The documents also covered intelligence not only about Ukraine, but about a few other countries as well. For example, the U.S. believes that Egypt had attempted to sell missiles to Russia, while Serbia, nominally a Russian ally, or at least a friend to Russia, approved selling military equipment to Ukraine. The U.S. also claims that China has agreed to supply Russia. However, Ukrainian sources have said that they have so far not seen any direct evidence of Chinese weapons or munitions or materiel being used by the Russians. So it is that's more of a variation of the theme that the Americans have been warning of a Chinese supplies to Russia for quite a while now, though beyond more Chinese electronics showing up in there in Russia's advanced weapons, there hasn't been any other evidence of kind of direct military support from China yet. Additionally, South Korea was, according to these documents, basically browbeaten or maybe even bullied into sending munitions to Ukraine, though it seems the U.S. was ultimately successful in convincing the South Koreans to send the munitions that they have for the U.S. weapons that are stationed in South Korea.
Yeah, I'm going to jump in on this last one just because it's not especially relevant to Ukraine. But also in this leaks was information that apparently within Israel, the security services, the heads of the intelligence and military community had kind of been plotting against Netanyahu to kind of constrain him from the whole mess of things that are happening in Israel right now. That it was just funny that that stuck out as one thing in the leaks that had nothing to do with Ukraine. It had to do with Israel being a complete political boiling pot at the moment. But yeah, continue.
That was that's a very kind of top level example of the leaked documents. Obviously, for legal reasons, as U.S. citizens, we are not technically allowed to view documents that are marked top secret, even if they have been leaked. And for our American listeners, again, for legal reasons, we are obliged to advise our U.S. listeners with U.S. citizenship that you are not legally allowed to view this document. However, if you do view these documents, you can go in a bit deeper and there is a lot of, let's say, interesting information in the leaks. There is scary information as well. Like I said, the locations of air defenses and such. There's also schedules and timelines for partner company for partner country supplies and deliveries to Ukraine, which if you are a talented analyst, you can translate into pretty good guesses in when such and such weapons will be visible or should appear on the front and draw conclusions from that, of course, as well as other minor non-Ukraine war related things. Aside from just the Israeli information, this leak covered quite a bit of current and ongoing U.S. operations around the globe, though obviously the Russian war against Ukraine is the big headliner there.
Yeah, and I'd also say that because a lot of this information is so old, some of it had been leaking out for over a year, actually, and we'll get into that in a second. Most of it is not especially actionable on the part of the Russians because it is so old. The location of the air defenses, for example, these are mobile. They're not fixed into one spot. They're moving around quite often. So I've been hearing analysis that that particularly is not so useful to the Russians. Though the thing about supply is more useful to them, because that is, again, like a scheduled, reliable thing. And also, there's a lot of information about the composition of new Ukrainian units. So if the Russians know where those units are now, they have a better idea of what is within them, at least at the time of last update, which if it was a full unit, so as it were, like a fully stocked unit, then they'll be able to tell that that kind of firepower existed at least when they showed up on the battlefield and can bring to the battlefield at a later time. But at the same time, again, not so much useful beyond that. Besides, we do find out regarding the casualty count numbers is that the Americans have concluded that the Russians have lost a large, large percentage of their special forces capabilities. These special forces units, such as the Fediva, the paratroopers, who were especially heavily used in the siege of Kiev, those are not easily retrained. When they die, it can take years and years and years to get someone with the same level of training and experience as the units that were wiped out in the siege of Kiev, taking Hostomel Airport, for example. And because of that, you obviously can't replenish these people very quickly. Even people coming straight out of basic training, there's still years of specialized training away from being at the same level as the people who just died. And because of this, the American idea is that Russia has a very limited supply of high-end soldiers at the moment.
Just going by some of the estimates included in the leaks, for example, one VDV unit is estimated to have something like 125 men remaining out of a pre-invasion force of 800. So you can imagine that if there are similar ratios among other Russian Spetsnaz and special forces units, that as a whole, Russia likely effectively may not even have a pool of elite soldiers in general anymore. They're all dead or heavily wounded or unable to partake in further combat.
There was also an analysis of Russian capabilities that basically said that they were very low. It was very, depending on which way you're looking for it, I was deciding whether to say optimistic view of them or a pessimistic view of them. But basically, the idea here is that the American analysts have said that the Russians cannot do much more than they already have, which seems obvious to someone who has been tracking the war, but it is interesting to hear from these experts. And because of this, we'll get into some of the reactions again later, but this is the main thing that the Russians have kind of hooked on to say that this was some kind of some trick by the Americans to release this data, because it makes Russia look bad. However, it is also pessimistic of Ukrainian capabilities. It said that this summer counteroffensive that we're looking forward to will have minimal effectiveness. And that can be cause for concern, but throughout this entire war, the Americans have been quite pessimistic about Ukrainian capabilities, and they've been proven wrong before, so it doesn't mean as much within that context. The Americans have been consistently underestimating the Ukrainians and overestimating the Russians, so when the Americans are giving both a kind of pessimistic outlook, we can adjust accordingly for that, I think.
And ironically, these leaks may show something that there have been rumors and hearsay about before, which is that the U.S. has more visibility into the operations of the Russian military than it does into the Ukrainian one. There have been multiple reports saying that the Ukrainians are hesitant or reluctant to fully share intelligence with the U.S., and much of that has to do with the fact that the U.S. is not sharing all of its intelligence on Russia. It is very picky and choosy with the information, the data that it shares. But we can see by the leaks that it clearly has quite a bit of insight into the inner workings of the Russian military.
Yeah, that is really the most important thing to me here, is that the leaks show that the U.S. has completely penetrated every aspect of the Russian security state. There is information about attacks with hours before they actually happen. There are tons of people on the CIA payroll within Russia. There's tons of people informing on every aspect of the Russian military-industrial complex. Russia has been very, very heavily compromised by American intel gathering.
Though I do want to note that I have seen intelligence analysts looked into the leaks say that the data contained in them is actually very, almost exclusively SIGINT, that is signals intelligence, mm-hmm. that is interception of digital and radio communications, satellite observations, and so on. And very little has been had been divined from human or human intelligence gathering.
But again, the flip side of this is that because the Russians are tipped off as to where the Americans are getting information from, that gives them an opportunity to find where the leaks are and try to plug them either by hook or by crook. So the fact that they know where they are leaking will help them fix where the leaks are.
So there is a limit to how much Russia can do this. We've known ever since the leaks by Edward Snowden that the U.S. intelligence services, and especially the National Security Agency, is more or less capturing every bit of traffic for the entire internet. That doesn't mean just U.S. traffic. That means the entire world. There have been multiple scandals involving U.S. wiretaps and U.S. hacking attempts against European partners, notably former German Chancellor Angela Merkel was revealed to have been directly tapped by U.S. intelligence, and they were eavesdropping on things like Brexit negotiations and the Nord Stream pipeline and so on. So the NSA clearly has the capability and clearly is continuing their policy of vacuuming every last bit of data on the internet. So it's going to be an uphill struggle, I think, for Russia to try and stop that process, since it's so ingrained in the very structure of the internet now. But all of the content of the leaks aside, one other huge factor is, of course, whodunit. And as of a few days ago, actually, we can say with decent certainty that we do know whodunit. Anthony, whodunit?
A creeper internet Nazi did it. Romeo, a creeper internet Nazi. So said internet Nazi was named Jack Teheria. Don't know exactly how to pronounce that, but T-E-I-X-E-I-R-A. And apparently he had a small community, a couple dozen people at most, on Discord. It's a chat room service that is frequently used for, I mean, many things, but especially gaming. It's very tied into gaming and various geek-related things. So this was primarily a gaming channel that he ran, but it was a racist gaming channel, it turns out. Everyone combined their gaming with racial slurs, which, honestly, not that rare. Gamers, not great people oftentimes.
There's even a joke about this one streamer used, which is having a heated gamer moment, aka a euphemism for using the N-word live in front of thousands of viewers.
Yeah, I'm kind of sad that euphemism has kind of dipped down for a while, of referring to doing a racism as an epic gamer move or something. Because that community is often not great.
So this kind of internet gamer Nazi guy, Jack Kakaria, or however you say it, the man is a Air National Guardsman. That is a National Guardsman who is a part of the Air Force, if I understand correctly, instead of the Army or the Marines or something like this. And he was working in an IT role, which possibly explains why he had access to this kind of documents at all. I've seen some conflicting reports on his exact job. It was either as an audiovisual guy, making sure that conference rooms and briefing rooms were set up for whatever meetings and briefings the military had, or he might have been a network administrator responsible for maintaining the networks that are used to connect bases to each other, or perhaps a jack of all trades who did a little bit of everything, like many IT specialists. But his unit was one that collated intelligence from disparate branches and agencies of the U.S. government, which is why the leaks are pretty comprehensive and cover a wide range of material and not just the Ukraine war or some specific aspect of the Ukraine war. The leaks themselves seem to be briefing documents, I believe, collected for the Joint Chiefs of Staff. So very high level kind of intelligence briefings.
Yeah, the idea is they would take briefings from other places and put them into more consolidated briefings. The government is a whole lot of short papers and briefings and white papers, and someone has to put it all together. And that someone was the people that he worked for. It's all very paperwork heavy. My advice to anyone looking to get into government specifically is to learn how to write as briefly as possible. They like their short sentences, short paragraphs, fit it onto a single page of paper.
And it'll turn into 70 pages of garbage anyway. So don't stress too much about that. But the more interesting aspect of this, I think, is less than this guy's identity than how he was discovered. So the kind of way these leaks came into the mainstream in the first place is because Russian Telegram channels began to share what they claimed was leaked U.S. intelligence documents that showed how poorly Ukraine was doing. There are multiple screenshots of edited documents, especially edited casualty counts, shared by Russian Telegram channels, where they obviously downplayed Russian losses and upplayed Ukrainian ones. Actually, an edited Russian version of one of the leaks was shared by Fox News host Tucker Carlson, which, if any of our listeners needed more evidence that Tucker Carlson is a direct traitor to the United States, who is actively working enemies of democracy to undermine the country, well, sharing Russian edited leaked U.S. intelligence documents on primetime broadcasting for millions upon millions of people is probably a pretty good signal of that particular trait. But Tucker Carlson aside, people started noticing that these documents were being shared by these Russian Telegram channels. Obviously, analysts and journalists began then looking into whether these documents were or were not legitimate. After some digging, they realized that they were legitimate, but edited. And of course, this prompted a search for the original documents. Open source investigative outlet Bellingcat was one of the leads in this investigation to discover the identity of the leaker. And they managed to track it down. Like we said, this leaker was on a gaming Discord where he had been sharing, apparently, excerpts of these intelligence briefings for quite a while. However, his fellow Nazi gamers didn't seem all that interested in these documents until, of course, just recently, when I imagine everyone became very interested in these documents. There's a lot of interesting stuff that Bellingcat recorded about their investigation. I highly recommend our listeners go and take a look at the article itself that they'd written about this, showing exactly how they managed to track down both the originals and how they were able to track it down not only onto a Discord server. And mind you, Discord is just like any other internet chat room. You can use whatever profile picture you like. You can set your username to whatever. There's no ID verification. So it was a pretty interesting analysis that Bellingcat members had to take in order to actually nail down the real life identity of this leaker.
And he did have personally identifiable information attached to his account.
He was not secure at all. As a helpful hint for our listeners, if you or anyone you know is planning to share sensitive or classified intelligence documents on the internet, do make an effort to be anonymous when sharing said documents. Host them on random or non-identifiable file hosts. Do not simply share them in a chat room where your profile picture is a photograph of your face.
Yeah, you know what? I'm going to give this out as general internet advice, especially to minors. Don't use your own info for things. This was a practice that we used back in the day of internet anonymity that has completely disappeared. I had thought that people involved in intelligence, like this guy was, even as the IT guy, not exactly as an intelligence officer, but you know, attached to an intelligence group, would know a little bit about OPSEC and anonymity, but thankfully for everyone else, he did not, because he's a dumb internet Nazi.
And again, I do highly recommend people go ahead and read the Bellingcat story on how they nailed this guy down. There's a lot of interesting details about image analysis, about comparative internet logs between different sites. And it is, in all, a pretty fascinating look at not only how these really dumb insular Nazi gaming communities work, but how these kinds of leaks happen and what can be done to track them down once they do happen.
Yeah, and I guess we'll close off talking about this by talking about some of the reactions. Well, for one, a lot of it, you could tell from our tone of voice here, the fact that he was a 21-year-old internet Nazi was pretty funny to me. I'm sorry. It's just amusing of how much of a loser this guy was, who did a major leak in order to impress his, a lot of them minors, friends on the internet. And because of that, he's now looking at spending the rest of his life in federal prison.
There's rumors that he did it specifically to brag about or prove some point in a Minecraft Discord server.
Yeah, the fact that it was specifically Minecraft.
Minecraft is a procedurally generated base building game where you are you go
it's
around.
Legos. It's Legos room. Is what it is.
Yes, it's basically a digital version of Legos. So whenever you think the story cannot possibly get any dumber, you were wrong. There is always a stupider detail to look at.
And here's what that made that even funnier for me is that the running joke for a long time is that when you say you're going to do something illegal on the internet, you close it off by saying, in Minecraft, I'm going to do some terrorism in Minecraft. Not really. Good luck, feds. In this case, he actually did it in Minecraft. He did the federal crime in Minecraft.
But it turns out, federal crimes don't care where you do the crimes. They care about the fact that the crime was committed.
Yeah. So, I mean, if you're involved in stupid internet shitposting culture, there's a lot of stuff here that makes you slap your head and say, of course they did that. This guy, potentially other people in the server were involved in what's called traditional Catholicism, which is...
Yeah, we didn't even touch the Tradcath crap.
Yeah, they're Tradcaths. And so these Tradcaths are called It exists a little bit in the real world. There are a handful of churches and stuff who say that the current pope is not the legitimate pope, and it's really someone else.
I'd like to note that according to Catholic theology, statements like this are heretical.
They're called set of vacantists. I'd never said that word out loud in my life, so excuse me. I've only ever read it or wrote it. It's a bunch of very super, super hyper conservative, a lot of the time tied to Franco's fascist regime in Spain or other Catholic parts of Europe that were run by Nazis, fascist movements in Mexico, that kind of thing. But as it exists on the internet, it's basically people who want to LARP as inquisitors from Warhammer. It doesn't go much further than that. They think that it is cooler to have Catholic or, in some cases, Orthodox. There's a similar version of people adopting Orthodox Christianity or be edgy, essentially, and pass off their weird racism as having some kind of higher spiritual purpose. But yeah, there's a lot to go deep in this. I'm not going to because it's a very dumb community, but basically they are doing it for the aesthetics. They're doing racism, but wanted racism for the aesthetics. And there's, you know, if you know the Red Scare people, they got involved in it. It's all very dumb. But I also want to look at how it's being perceived on some of the more pro-Russian spheres in the U.S. We mentioned Tucker Carlson, who did a whole segment on how these documents show that Ukraine is losing, and that's why we need to stop supporting them and that kind of
thing. Again, Tucker Carlson used the Russian edited, and it's like known that those particular images that he used were Russian edited prior to him using it. He used those images to make that point.
Yeah, Tucker Carlson, Nazi. Otherwise, other people within that sphere are comparing him to, you know, the Snowdens, the Mannings, the reality winner.
There's been a number of left-wing personalities who have compared him to Julian Assange.
Julian Assange. And, okay, you can kind of take these people on a case-by-case basis. I do not like Julian Assange. For example, you can kind of look at each of these on a case-by-case basis of whether or not their leak was worth doing or not. But within each of those cases, they were leaking something that might be interesting for the world to know. It would be nice to know sometimes if the government is surveilling you. And the process of you getting that information might have crossed other lines that may or not have been acceptable. And again, case by case. But in this one, it was just intel about military movements. There's nothing in there about how the government's doing anything bad in the U.S. or anything like that. It's not whistleblowing. There's no whistle being blown here. It's just spying.
And that particular fact has drawn a interesting reaction from many Ukrainian commentators who were convinced prior to the leaker being identified by Bellingcat and others as being a Russian operation, and who I've seen some of them claiming that the U.S. is lying, that they just arrested a patsy, and this is still a Russian intel operation. And that seems to be a pretty common view amongst Ukrainians, that because these leaked documents were so focused on Ukraine and so focused on specifically the military aspects, that this could not be anything other than a Russian intelligence operation. For the record, we believe the reporting done by Bellingcat and the Washington Post, New York Times, and others in establishing the identity of a leaker as Jack Teheria, however you say it, he does not seem to have any connections to Russian intelligence. No one's uncovered a secret bank account stuffed full with rubles transferred from the Kremlin. He doesn't seem to have had any personal contacts with Russian nationals. By all accounts, as far as all of the evidence shows, Jack Tahara acted alone as a weird internet Nazi to win an argument.
And there had been other leaks in the past by people trying to just win arguments on the internet. As recently as January, there was a leak on War Thunder forums, War Thunder being a game where basically you control tanks to shoot at other people controlling tanks. And it is frequently done on these kinds of forums to have arguments over the technical specifications of these tanks. It's very, very nerdy. And on occasion, and specifically in January, but several times before that, people have used actual classified information from the U.S. military as far as, you know, manuals saying the exact specifications of these things that are supposed to be secretive in order to win these arguments on the internet.
People like being right on the internet.
Yeah, maybe a lot of people have security clearances, and a lot of these people with security clearances are not always wise with them. Although in this case, I think there very much is a case to be made that maybe there should be more ideological screening for these security clearances. Maybe a weirdo internet Nazi should not have access to highly classified information by the U.S. government. The military has been having much more investigations in recent years for people with extremist ideology. It has happened in several countries, actually. The U.S. has done it. Britain has done it. Germany has done it to root out these far-right aspects. But the military is a conservative place, and within those conservative places, there's going to be far-right actors. It's pretty universal. But maybe you should be asking these people how weird they are. I made a joke on Twitter saying before we give anyone access to classified information, we should ask them their opinion on the Ghostbusters movie, the Ghostbusters remake, rather. And if they get irrationally mad over it, rather than not having any idea what you're talking about, don't let them in near anything important because they're weird.
You can simply ask them, what is their stance on ethics and game journalism?
Exactly. This all comes back to Gamergate. Again, huge rabbit hole we don't need to go on. If you're real, if you know, you know. If someone cares about Gamergate, we should not give them guns or anything.
Or anything, really.
They should not be trusted. So, but building on the idea of the Ukrainians thinking this is more complicated than it actually seems to be, like we've said, it seems to just boil down to someone having access to information and spreading it when they weren't supposed to, and now he's going to go to jail for a very, very long time. Oh, and just to cap off the idea of reactions to this, the Russians, like I said earlier, are kind of saying that this is an info op by the U.S. to make Russia look bad. Also, doesn't really hold any water.
So that's it for this week. Thank you very much for listening. Please remember to follow us on whatever platform you're listening to this podcast on. Like, check out our Twitter at Hype Ukraine. If you can afford it, we would very much appreciate a patron subscription or other donation, or simply share the podcast with your friends and family to make sure that people are getting Ukraine's voice from Ukraine in Ukraine from Ukrainians.
Now we'd like to take our time to thank our patrons. Thank you very much for making this all possible and financially supporting this project. So thank you very much to Deborah Grazer, Will Stevens, David Shepard, Dawson, Giorgio, Ivana Kokratskaya, Michael Drucker, Anna Karen Person, Anonymous, Devi, Etienne, Justin Devendorf, Kevin Albritton, Michael Wickman, Mike Perrone, Sam Toman, Silas Frank, Theo, Adam Poppenheimer, Aiden McDonald, Alex Grochmal, Anastasia, Barbara, Big Rob, Captain Technical, Chris Bennington, Chris Walker, Crystal Burns, Daniel Spring, David Wall, Emily Bavona, Eric Honnold, Grace Krause, Had to Laugh, Jacob Holm, James Wise, Jenny Louise, Jerd, Julia, Ken Shoemaker, Christian Swanland, Laura De Leon, Levy Grove, Lottie, Marguerite, Matt Miller, Melissa Kelselko, an anonymous poster, Noam Hart, Paul Bailey, Randy McNerlin, Sanjay, Scott Gengris, Scott Tarkiuk, Steve Bien, Stuart Akers, Susan Winter, T. Bart, Thomas Sobiek, Veronique, and Victoria Elaine Taneva. If I've pronounced any of your names wrong or want to be taken off the list for whatever reason, just let me know. But yes, thank you all very much for your support. And Slava Ukraini.
Heroim Slava.
Thank you.